Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, we have reports from Anne Ball, Brian Lynn, and Jonathan Evans. We close the show with our American History Program, The Making of a Nation. But first, here's Brian Lynn.
United States health officials say the number of twin births nationwide has dropped to their lowest level in 10 years. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, reported the decrease. Twin births nationwide began to increase about 40 years ago, CDC records show. From 1980 until 2014, the total number rose 79%. But from 2014 to 2018, the twin birth rates fell 4%. Last year, there were 32.6 twins for every 1,000 total births, the CDC reported. While the latest drop was not huge, officials said they consider it a good sign. Pregnancy with more than one child raises the risks of complications and death for both the mother and the baby. Dimitri Kissin is a doctor who works with the CDC's Division of Reproductive Health. He told the Associated Press that many people do not realize there can be serious risks with twin births. In the media, he said, there are often stories about very cute twins and talking about how great to have two babies at the same time. Such stories ignore the health risks, Kissin added. In 2018, about 124,000 babies born in the United States were twins. That represents about one in every 31 births. Health experts say there is no single explanation for the falling twin birth rates. However, Joyce Martin, the lead writer of the report, suggested one likely reason. She noted that the falling rates were only among white women and in women 30 years of age or older. Women from these groups are the biggest users of in vitro fertility treatments. In vitro fertilization is when doctors combine male and female cells to create an embryo, which is later implanted in a woman's uterus. This technique results in about 15% of all births involving more than one baby. In the past, it was common for fertility experts to implant two or more embryos to improve the chances of a successful birth. This greatly increased the woman's chances of having more than one baby. In recent years, however, the method has changed. Fertility specialists now grow embryos longer in the lab and carry out more tests for genetic problems. They then choose the best single embryo to implant. The CDC's Dimitri Kissin says that today, about two-thirds of in vitro fertility treatments involve just one embryo. Aaron Steyer is an infertility treatment specialist in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. He told the AP the success rate for one embryo rose from about 20% in the 1980s to around 50% today. Steyer said that health insurance companies and medical organizations have increasingly been pushing doctors to implant just a single embryo. More and more patients are also accepting the method to improve their chances of a successful pregnancy. He added, I'm Brian Lynn.
A new device is helping those who are blind to see. It does this in a new way by helping them experience the world around them. Jason Esterhazen lost his eyesight after a car accident. He never thought he would be able to see light or movement again. But now, with the movement of a switch, his world suddenly grew brighter. He says,
I still can't put it into words. I mean, from being able to see absolutely nothing, it's pitch black, to all of a sudden seeing little flickers of light move around.
It is not full or normal sight, but Esterhazen can move about in the world around him. Dr. Nader Paradian is one of the researchers at the University of California at Los Angeles Medical Center who worked on the new technology.
Being able to tell where a doorway is, being able to tell where the sidewalk begins or ends, or where the crosswalk is, are all extremely meaningful events that can help these people regain some form of independence.
The new technology uses several parts. One is a small device placed in the brain. The other parts are a video camera on sunglasses and a processing device that can be carried in a person's clothes. When the user points the camera, a signal goes to the processor and then back to the glasses. The glasses then communicate wirelessly with the device in the brain. The information causes a pattern to develop in the part of the brain called the visual cortex. The pattern helps users detect or see movement and shapes of light, and it all happens in seconds. Paradian says this technology is a first.
We basically have the video camera and the video processing unit functioning or performing the functions of what the eye normally does.
Esterhazen is one of just two people in the U.S. testing this technology. He describes what he sees.
There's little white dots on a black background. It's like looking up at the stars at night.
The technology, called Orion, is manufactured by a company called Second Sight. It is being tested at the UCLA Medical Center in California and the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. Esterhazen says the results are amazing.
Someone moving across the room, walking past me or walking away from me, or it's a light against the wall. It was just amazing to have some form of functional vision again.
He adds that now he can do everyday activities around his home that he once could not. It is easier to walk outside.
Crossing the road is much easier now, much safer for me, because I can look down and just follow the white line that's painted on the road.
The researchers believe that one day this technology could help people who have lost their vision because of illnesses like glaucoma or diabetes. It may also help those with poor vision or who were born blind. I'm Ann Ball.
Nathan Wallach is a firefighter in the American city of Peoria, Illinois. He also likes to use bows and arrows for sport. Now, that sport is helping him make extra money and improve the local environment. People pay Wallach to lead hunts on the Illinois River to kill Asian carp, an invasive fish. Nathan Wallach is one of several private boat operators helping to stop Asian carp from entering Lake Michigan, one of the largest bodies of water in the United States. The hunt takes place in an area of the river about 160 kilometers from Lake Michigan. Wallach's customers shoot arrows at the carp as the silvery fish jump out of the water behind the boat. Wallach told Reuters, "The name of the game is try and knock them down as much as possible and keep them from getting into the Great Lakes." On a recent hunting trip, Wallach and his customers caught about 100 carp. That is not very many compared to the number of fish caught by commercial fishing boats working for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Kevin Irons is a program manager with the department. He told Reuters they have removed 3.9 million kilograms of Asian carp from the Upper Illinois River since 2010. Iron said his department gives the fish caught in removal operations to tradespeople. The sellers process them into non-food products such as fish oil, fertilizer, and pet food. Irons added that his agency welcomes the relatively small aid from carp fishermen like Wallach. So far, Lake Michigan and three of the five other Great Lakes, Superior, Huron, and Ontario, remain free of Asian carp, Iron said. Just two carp have ever been seen in the Illinois Waterway, a shipping path that links Lake Michigan to the Illinois River. Both were caught. Four Asian carp species now live in much of the Mississippi River. One species, grass carp, has made it into one of the Great Lakes, Lake Erie. The Asian carp can weigh up to 45 kilograms. The fish feed entirely on small plants and animals that float freely in oceans and other bodies of water. The carp threaten to upset food chains of the waterways they live in while crowding out native fish. In the lower Illinois River, for example, they now make up 70% of water life, Iron said. Asian carp come from China. They were brought into the United States in the 1970s to help control growth of plant life in commercial catfish ponds in the South. The carp found their way into the Mississippi River through flooding and accidental releases. Since then, they have invaded many of the nation's rivers and streams. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week, we talked about slavery in new American states and whether Congress could set the conditions for statehood. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 settled the issue for a short time. The compromise said that Missouri could enter the Union as a slave state, and Maine could enter as a free state. By approving these two states at the same time, Congress kept a balance of power in the Senate between slave and free states. But the compromise also said no more states in the Northern Louisiana Territory could be admitted as slave states. As a result, slavery could not enter the new areas of the United States. Some people did not like the compromise. They said it limited the ability of slave owners to settle in the country's western territory. Others said the Constitution did not permit Congress to say that new states had to be slave or free. Even President Monroe did not believe the government had the power to make such decisions. Yet he approved the compromise. He was trying, he said, to avoid a civil war. Monroe's decision to approve the compromise did not hurt his election chances in 1820. There was, at this time, really only one party, the Republican Party, and he was its leader. The opposition Federalist Party was dead. It was no longer an election threat. So Monroe was the only presidential candidate in the election of 1820. He received the vote of every elector except for one. William Plummer of New Hampshire voted for John Quincy Adams. He explained later that George Washington had been the only president to get all the electoral votes. Plummer said he did not want anyone to share this honor given to Washington. Monroe's first 4 years as president had been successful. He had increased the size of the United States. Florida was now part of the country, and the problem of slavery had been temporarily settled. There had been economic problems, some of the worst in the nation's history, but the situation was getting better. And the nation was growing. As it grew, new problems developed between its different sections. There were really three separate areas with very different interests. The northeastern states had become the industrial center of the nation. The southern states were agricultural, with large farms that produced cotton, rice, and tobacco. Much of the work on these farms was done by slave labor. The western states were areas of small farms where grain was produced with free labor. It was a place where the land did not cost much and where people could make a new start and build a new life. This division of the nation into different sections with opposing interests ended the one-party system of Monroe's administration. The industrial Northeast wanted high taxes on imported products to protect its industry from foreign competition. This part of the country also believed the national government should pay for roads and waterways to get their products to markets. The South did not agree to high import taxes. These taxes raised the prices on all goods. and import taxes on foreign goods might cause foreign nations to raise import taxes on Southern cotton and tobacco. The South also opposed spending federal money for roads and canals. The mountains through parts of the Southern Atlantic states would make road building difficult and canals impossible. The Western states supported government aid in building roads and canals. The Ohio and Mississippi rivers were the only inexpensive transportation systems for moving their products to markets. The Westerners also supported high taxes on imports because they believed such taxes would raise the prices of their agricultural products. The separate interests of these different sections produced an exciting campaign in the next presidential election. Each section had at least one candidate. Several had more than one. The campaign began almost as soon as Monroe was elected for the second time. At one time, as many as 16 men thought of themselves as presidential possibilities. By 1822, the number had been reduced to 6 men. John Quincy Adams was the only Northern candidate. He was an extremely able man. He was at the time Secretary of State, and there were few jobs in government he could not do and do well. But many people found him cold and questioning. His father was John Adams, the second president of the United States. The West had two candidates. One was Henry Clay of Kentucky, popularly known as Harry of the West. He was a great lawyer, congressman, Speaker of the House, and senator. The other was Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. Jackson knew little about government. He was a fighter, a man of the people. In the election of 1824, Jackson got the most electoral votes, 99, but he needed 130 to win a majority. The Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, was second. Treasury Secretary William Crawford was third, and Henry Clay of Kentucky was fourth. Because none of the candidates got a majority of the votes, the decision went to the House of Representatives. The House voted on only the three top candidates for president. The most powerful man in Congress, Henry Clay, was not, therefore, a candidate. But Clay's support would be the greatest help any of the candidates could receive. All three wanted his support. Treasury Secretary Crawford had suffered a serious illness before the election, and his health was bad. Clay felt he could not support him for that reason. This left Adams and Jackson. Clay did not agree with all of Adams' policies, but he did believe Adams had the education and ability to be president. Clay did not like Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He knew Jackson was poorly educated and easy to anger. Clay did not think Jackson would be a good president. So Clay decided to support Adams for president. He said nothing about this for a time. Several of Clay's friends visited Adams. They told him that Clay's supporters in the West would be pleased if Adams, as president, named Clay as Secretary of State. Adams told them that if the votes of the West elected him president, he would put a Westerner in his cabinet. But he would not promise that the Westerner would be Clay or that the cabinet job would be Secretary of State. Clay had still not said publicly which candidate he supported. But late in January, a Philadelphia newspaper published an unsigned letter. The letter charged that Clay and Adams had made a secret agreement. Clay, the letter said, would give his support to Adams. In exchange, Adams would name Clay as his Secretary of State. Clay was furious. He not only denied the charge, but offered to fight a duel with the letter writer. But whoever wrote the letter to the newspaper refused to say anything. Clay was sure Jackson's supporters were responsible. Snow was falling in Washington on the morning of February 9th, the day that Congress would elect the president. At noon, members of Congress walked into the House of Representatives. Each state had one vote for president. Adams was sure he would get the votes of 12 states. Crawford had the votes of 4 and Jackson 7. New York was the question. 17 of the New York congressmen were for Adams, and 17 were against him. Adams needed just one of these votes to get the vote of New York and become president. One of those New Yorkers opposed to Adams was a rich old man who represented the Albany area, Stephen Van Rensselaer. Although Van Rensselaer had supported Crawford or Jackson, he really was not sure now whom to support. When the New York congressman voted, Van Rensselaer was still not certain. He put his head down on his desk and asked God to help him make the right choice. After this short prayer, he opened his eyes and saw on the floor at his feet a piece of paper with Adams' name on it. Van Rensselaer picked it up and put it in the ballot box as his vote. This gave Adams the vote of the state of New York and made him the next president of the United States. 2 days later, Adams told President Monroe that he had decided to offer the job of Secretary of State to Clay. He said he was doing so because of the Western support he had received. Clay accepted the offer. Now Jackson was sure that Clay had sold his vote to Adams for the top cabinet job. He wrote to a friend, "Was there ever before such barefaced corruption? What is this trade of vote for office, if not bribery?" Jackson, himself a senator, showed his feelings when the Senate was asked to approve Clay as Secretary of State. He voted no, and 13 other senators joined him against the nomination. But they were too few prevent Clay from getting the job. With Clay as his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams began his first term as president.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.